Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. We're obviously here to discuss the most important sporting event of the year, the cage fight on the White House lawn. Helen, you've been oiling up.
Yes, I have. Well spotted.
Better do that again.
Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name's Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the I studio with Helen Lewis, Adam McQueen and Sarah Shannon. We're here to discuss the most important sporting event of the year so far, obviously the cage fight on the White House lawn. Helen, you've been observing the star-spangled biceps. What can you tell us?
I have. I mean, not with the actual cage fighting bit, because in a classic Trump stitch-up, the broadcast rights for that were exclusively given to, not CBS, the thing that they own, for it's free to air, but Paramount Plus. So you had, they were pay-per-view.
What?
Well, like a monthly subscription fee. And sure enough, the two people who were in charge of Paramount, the Ellisons, were there at the match and are Trump donors and got his sign off for their merger with Warner Brothers. And that is the story of the White House cage fight. Yes, okay. The main story is that the fact that it was, I've never seen a more tastelessly American occasion. Extraordinary. Everything. Imagine something that you think of as like peak tasteless American.
Yeah. Monster truck.
Yeah. No, they had people jumping motorbikes, Evel Knievel style, off little ramps. They had a weigh-in where they flew a bald eagle over it. They had a fly past when they were doing the national anthem.
This sounds so brilliant. I am so subscribing to Paramount Plus now.
they had the walk-in started in the Oval Office. So there's a great shot of one of the fighters staring at an original copy of the Declaration of Independence, sort of going, yeah. Then turning around, walking past, you know, the gold signage he's had put in, the Hall of Presidents with Biden and the auto pen and then all the pictures of it, and then out into the octagon. It was the campest thing you've ever seen. It was amazing.
This is even before the lads with their tops off wrestling with each other. Right, okay.
It was the most American thing you've ever seen.
Wow. And in not being for all Americans, only for those with a particular Paramount Plus subscription.
Right, exactly. But
it's very American.
So the UFC paid for it. So Dana White, who runs the UFC, he is a big Trump, long-time Trump friend. When that franchise was really struggling, it was banned for a long time in America because it was seen as being too violent. John McCain called it human cockfighting.
Who would have thought something called ultimate fighting could possibly be violent?
Right. But Trump held, Trump let them hold matches in his casinos, essentially. So he did Dana White favours back in the day. Dana White now said, well, look, we'll pay for all this. We'll build the octagon. We'll clean up the octagon. You won't have to, you know, taxpayers won't have to pay a penny.
Okay.
But essentially functioned as the most giant advert for UFC as a concept. So it worked for him. Trump invested in TKO Holdings after the bout was announced. Only one of his smaller announced.
TKO Holdings being?
The MMA company, Dana White's company.
Okay.
So, you know, again, once again, I'm sure there'll be many ways in which the Trump family will have got its beak wet as a result of about these men clattering seven bells out of each other, because that's how he rolls. Mark Zuckerberg was there, another recent convert to the joys of being sweaty and topless with other fellas. It was allegedly part of America 250.
Right.
But really, it was America's favourite president, Donald Trump's 80th birthday.
Right.
And someone did a great tweet, which was like, this is the ultimate, he is Caesar maxing, right? We have...
I don't like that. That makes me feel very queasy.
He had a peace deal with Persia, a gladiator fight in front of the Imperial Palace. Yeah. And then your elderly emperor and his sort of slightly useless sons all there. Like, he has Caesar maxed. You can't take that away from him.
Right.
Oh my God.
How did it end for Caesar? I can't remember just offhand. Anyway, so, I mean, we don't need to get too chin-strokey about what does this mean about America? But it is interesting that it comes the same within a day of the announcement that there's a deal with Iran that's going to end the war, supposedly with tremendous victory, although everyone can see that it's not really.
Right, but it does tell you something very interesting about the MAGA movement. All the posts about it were like, libs would say that they hate this because, you know, it's tasteless, but that's because they hate America. Trump's approval rating is bad, right? Actually, only 18% of people said they thought it was an appropriate time to be having a big cage fight on the White House lawn, given that gas prices are so high, like, you know, the economy's not doing particularly well. So it was one of those kind of great moments, like the election night, where it was just a lot of people exulting in owning the libs. And like, oh, I tell you who won't like this, you know, which is the kind of animating glue of lots of bits of that. And they're not happy unless they feel that someone else is upset.
Okay.
And, you know, you can say that that's, I think that's a little slightly decadent, but it's It's what makes them happy, Andy. Mm. That's what we can say about the MAGA movement. Apart from anything else, aside from any of the ideological occurrences, they all just like the idea that they're upsetting
right.
some Tell you what group this... of college professors.
Tell you what this doesn't contain, the seeds of its own destruction. Am I right, Lance? Yeah.
I know. But, you know, poor old... I mean, Trump did go to a Knicks game and sure enough got booed at it. I mean, fair enough, that's in New York, which has just elected Mamdani as mayor. But and he, once again, he looked a bit sleepy. And, you know, at the match, you could see once again the hand with the bruising covered up by my makeup. So there is definitely a kind of elderly Caesar vibe going on.
Right.
I think he stayed awake throughout the whole of USC, but then, you know, they were firing people out of cannons.
That's why the motorbikes and things were there. Just came so noisy that he wouldn't nod off.
A bald eagle was
clicking on his shoulder the whole time.
Yeah.
And didn't they give whopping great prizes from their cryptocurrency firm to the fighters?
Well, this comes back to, actually, if you want to look at the kind of who actually rules the world. Like the people who sponsored this were Ram Trucks. This is what I mean about it being almost like parodically American. Ram Trucks and Crypto.com. And actually, they had an advert on the side of the Octagon for the Riyadh season.
Both of those sound like made-up things that they would put in the back of a film because they can't use the real. Just a bit more. Crypto.com. Yeah, I mean, it's slightly more imaginative,
what
maybe?
What should we call our truck? Oh, I don't know. Big truck, hard truck.
Ram truck.
Yeah, ram truck.
Is that a but good thing?
They were advertising the Riyadh season, which is the Crown Prince's kind of big hoopla and having and like inviting lots of cultural figures. You know, like the Rio Comedy Festival that I went to and the Mr. Beast World and all that kind of stuff all comes to Saudi Arabia. So this is just, apart from anything else, it was just a giant festival of people who've got business interests tied up with Trump and the Trump family getting to have their big night out. It was very hard to get a ticket. They gave most of the tickets out to members of the military, but they obviously had some of the Trump family there, and there were some VIP packages. And then you could watch it from on the mall next to the... next to the reflecting pool, which he's had repainted, although it's immediately covered over in algae again because the drainage isn't sorted out. But they've just announced there's going to be an America 250 rodeo.
Whoa.
See, you're
talking about that.
We're talking.
Wow. Yeah. But they've had to cancel the series of concerts because too many of the singers kept pulling out because they had been sold it. You know, this has been, the America 250 stuff has been in the works for ages, and there was a bipartisan commission that was in charge of doing it. But then Trump set up a competing one that was very much a MAGA one. And so as a result, the whole thing has become super partisan. It hasn't so much become a celebration of America and its founding ideals as like Hail to the Chief, basically.
The concert had some extraordinary people before they pulled out, didn't they? I mean, they had Vanilla Ice, who everyone has sort of forgotten existed. And Milli Vanilli,
I know, which I
one thought... of whom is dead, and neither of whom were singers. So it's an odd band to kind of book, isn't it?
Yeah, Trump did this spectacularly petulant tweet, which was like, I don't even want overpriced singers. I'd much rather have a rally. And then it concluded with going, I'm a bigger draw than Elvis was at his peak. Again, the question, how did that one end? But it was, so he's had a little foot stomp, but this was kind of I think this was the one that he was really excited about.
Right.
Because it was all... military, like guys standing around in uniforms, the brass band, the you know, like everything that he loves.
Bombast,
pageantry and pomp.
We're not in a position to criticise because I watched The Trooping of the Colour on Saturday just going, what is this is just extraordinary.
Yeah, but The Trooping of the Colour isn't sponsored by, I don't know, Branston's Pickles or any other iconic British brand.
Still pretty camp though, those little gold uniforms.
So funny, in association, but it had to be something really crap that was really like degrading. It'd have to be like in association with Imodium or something. Did you really need the money, guys?
Sam is there.
Oh dear. Should we talk briefly about the Iran deal to, you know, triumphantly?
Is it actually happening this time? Because I feel like it's about 250 years of Trump saying we're going to have a deal this weekend.
Well, you can tell that all the European leaders are slightly don't really believe it until they see it because they keep saying it's very important we must have toll-free access to the Strait of Hormuz. And that's one of the things that Trump has announced will definitely be happening. So the fact that they keep going, no, we really, what a great deal would include would definitely be this.
Yes. I mean, the timing of the announcement is another thing that people who specialise in watching it do like to point out, which is that it came on Sunday night before the markets opened, which almost every other week since the war began has seen Trump announcing on Sunday night, hey, it's all over, terrific news. This is at least a memorandum of understanding, as it were, that we'll have 60 days of further ceasefire. But, you know, even within it, I mean, Trump said the oil must flow immediately and then said, clarified later on, well, the oil is going to flow as of Friday once the Iranians have demined the strait and subject to further agreements. So again, it's a bit partial and a bit tentative. And, you know, it depends on whether people are happy with insurance to go through the Strait of Hormuz now.
And the ceasefire so far has been one of the more shooty ceasefires, hasn't it?
Well,
there's been an awful lot of sort of war stuff still going on.
Israel went and said, well, it's not our ceasefire, can't make us. And once its campaign in Lebanon excluded from it anyway. The thing I think that's very worrying about it long term is essentially what Iran has learned from this is that that Donald Trump doesn't have the stones to actually put boots on the ground. So he went in saying, we want regime change. He hasn't got that. He said, we don't want any nuclear weapons. Well, that was the whole point of the 2015 deal. And actually, he now doesn't have an inspection regime as part of this necessarily. And he's also taught Iran that they have the most amazing bargaining chip in the world to use against America, which is closing the Strait of Hormuz. So what happens if in September, as the midterms are coming up, they just suddenly close it again, and gas prices in America jump by $1 up, you know. And then at that point, Trump is desperate, desperate for them to do it. They will have the most incredible negotiating tactic. So I can't see this, you know, if they had managed to institute peaceful democracy and stop Iran getting any nuclear weapons, then that would have been a good outcome. What they essentially, to my mind, have done is just wholesale advertise their lack of commitment to a full-scale war.
Yeah, and this is the other thing we should say, is that just to remind everyone, Trump's words at the beginning of the war, finally, to the great proud people of Iran, I say tonight, the hour of your freedom is at hand. When we are finished, take over your government. It will be yours to take. This will probably be your only chance for generations. Obviously now, the regime's in an even, I mean, it's suffered a lot of damage, but it's in an even stronger position than it was.
But it's not only that. It feels like the Iranian people have kind of rallied behind, or a lot of them in a way. I mean, do you remember when he made the threat about bombing them back to the beginning of civilization or whatever it was? There were people turning out in droves to kind of stand on bridges and bits of infrastructure that they were thought were going to be targets, kind of making themselves into human shields. It felt like, I mean, if you want to kind of pull a people together, start bombing them.
Especially a people that have been united against their government a year earlier, Nasser Amini.
The Ayatollah is looking 40 years younger than he ever did. I mean,
we don't know, to be fair. No one's actually seen it.
Anyway, it's a sort of classic Trump result, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a kind of. But it's interesting that people have finally learned when he came out. When I've got this amazing peace deal, everyone went, all right, well, so we'll see how it goes. I mean, the markets, as you say, rallied, but they've just rallied so many times. I've never seen people more enthusiastically ready to believe things that a mad bloke has just said to them. The thing that's interesting is to go back to the Iranian people rising up, is that does seem to have been something that was fed to them by Netanyahu. He came over and did this presentation in the Situation Room, like a sort of PowerPoint, and he said, no, honestly, if you just do it, they're gagging for it, they're ready to rise up, and that seems to have been the basis on which he's done it.
Trump's reaction was to blame the American people, to say, I don't know that America has the appetite to do what I would really much prefer doing. This was a few days before the deal, such as it is, was signed, which is I'd love to nuke them, but, you know, my people are cowards, so
It's really up there. He's just said some extraordinary things in the last couple of weeks. He said, I don't care about inflation. That was another great one. Yep. I don't care about the economy. Affordability is a hoax perpetrated by the Democrats.
Right.
he's Caesar-maxing. Right. There's a new book coming out by two White House reporters, Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan, in which they have got essentially verbatim transcripts of things that happened in the Situation Room, which is really quite like a level of leakage that is kind of unprecedented, like word-for-word stuff. So the suspicion has to be that some people who are already looking ahead to the post-Trump future are very keen to say that when terrible decisions were made, they were not involved with them. So there's a kind of meta play going on here as well. Talking of which, both Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance were obviously at the UFC. They're the kind of two heirs apparent.
Did they partake?
Exactly, they did not. And young Barron was there, along with the other sons, including the one who got married last weekend and Trump didn't bother to go. He'll go to this, but not that.
Oh, God. It'd be one way to sort out the succession, wouldn't it? All get in the ring, guys.
Barron would win. Barron is like 8 feet tall. He'd take a lot of them.
He's very, but J.D. Vance has been looking much trimmer of late.
Helen, we can't do Helen's Ozempic watch every single fortnight on this podcast. We should turn to the other biggest sporting engagement of the year so far. Which countries have we all picked or had forced on us in the Eyes World Cup sweepstake? I'll go first. Ghana.
Egypt.
Germany.
Oh.
Korea, who have won one match. I see. So I think I'm on my way.
If they keep going like that, they can't lose. Right, so we're here to talk about the World Cup, but we thought we'd make it as eye-ish as possible. So the latest issue of the Mag has a World Cup theme. And Sarah, you write a great deal about sport at the Eye. And this is a rather unusual World Cup in that it's a lot larger, so it's a lot easier to get in. But it's also quite a lot harder to get in to the country that's hosting it. Is that fair?
I think that's fair, yes. There's never been more matches, more tickets available, but can you actually get there to watch your team? Iran is the sort of top story on this. They can't actually even have their training camp in the country. I mean, it's this extraordinary situation where the host nation and one of the competing nations are at war with each other.
Yeah.
So Iran was supposed to be based in Tucson, Arizona, but they're now in Tijuana in Mexico, okay. Which is pretty much the last place any Mexican football team wants to be based, because it's miles away from other footballing centres. They've got really sort of rough AstroTurf, but the local Mexicans are apparently making them really welcome, cheering them when they come out of their hotel and asking for autographs and so on. So they're doing their best to make up for the lack of welcome from the host. But Trump said that they couldn't come and stay in America because their lives and safety would be in danger.
So this is elements of the support staff, the training staff, the management staff, basically, because various people have applied and not been allowed in.
Yes.
Some have reapplied and then got in on appeal. But
so the Iranian Football Federation president, he's not allowed in because of his links to the IRGC. There's lots of other support staff that couldn't be there. They were going to do their press conference in L.A., yesterday, and some of the press team haven't been allowed to go. So somebody said, well, who's going to be advising them on tactics in terms of press tactics? And they said, well, perhaps the kit man might have some advice for them. But anyway, yes, it's been a rocky road for them to get here for sure. Their star striker also wasn't picked for the team because he has spoken up about women's rights in the past. Two of their matches are going to be in Los Angeles, which is the sort of home of the huge Iranian diaspora. About 375,000 Iranians live there. I think there's an area of Los Angeles that they call Tehrangeles because there's so many Iranians that live there. Yeah, so they all want to go along and protest against the Iranian government and wave their pre-revolutionary sun and lion flags, but that's not going to be allowed. Because FIFA won't allow political statements to be made unless it's Gianni Infantino in a MAGA hat, and then it's okay.
These are not the only people who've had their access to the World Cup restricted.
No, I mean, four countries are under total travel bans. There's Iran, Haiti, Ivory Coast and Senegal, so none of their fans can go. And then there's other countries that have found it incredibly difficult to get visas to go, countries like Ghana, Congo, Cape Verde, and just to prove they're not only anti-African countries, Uzbekistan's also found it really difficult to get visas to go to the World Cup. And then there's this Somali referee, Omar Artan, who he had a diplomatic visa, he had a single entry visa to get into the US. He would have been the first Somalian to have refereed a World Cup game, so it was a big deal. But he arrived at Miami Airport. He was questioned for 10 hours, and then he was told no, he had to go home. And Andrew Giuliani, son of Rudy, who is leading Trump's US World Cup task force, he said that...
Because of course he is.
Yeah, of course he is. He said that, you know, we can't let somebody in that might have been talking to terrorists or might even be a terrorist. But UEFA, the European football people, who are a bit more sensible, have basically done as a kind of an FU to Trump and FIFA and US customs in general, have said, why don't you come and officiate at the UEFA Super Cup final, which is in August. So... Wow. One man's terrorist is another man's top referee.
Is some of this about being a very ostentatiously tough on immigration, though? Because there was an issue with, was it the Iranian women's team? Some of them defected and then undefected at a recent match?
Yes, that was in Australia, wasn't it? Yeah. I mean, I really feel for the players because they're in a really lose-lose situation, I think, because if they say anything that even remotely hints at the fact that they might not love their regime, they're going to be in enormous trouble when they get home. And if they say anything that's pro the regime, they're going to have all those Iranian-Americans in the LA stadium shouting at them. And then they've got another issue, which is that the they've got two matches in Los Angeles and then they've got one in Seattle. And that's been designated as a pride match. And they're playing Egypt, so it couldn't be more perfect, really.
Those appropriate teams in the world. Yeah.
And apparently they did ask that it could be undesignated a pride match, but for once, FIFA decided to do the right thing and they stuck to their guns and it will be a pride.
Rainbow laces all round.
I mean, Seattle's a very notoriously LGBT-friendly city. So
exactly.
I see where they picked that. Mm. But presumably, I'm going to take a wild stab in the dark and say it'll be one sort of nauseatingly sickly pre-roll video about how inclusion is great and everybody should be like valued. And
yes.
Then, nothing, and then no money to LGBT organisations.
Yes,
nothing.
At which point the Iranian and Egyptian teams will all stare at their shoes.
So does any of this politics over the visa stuff and, you know, all of these different difficulties, does any of this affect whether this is a successful World Cup or not? And does a successful World Cup, does that definition change depending on whether you're the USA or FIFA or Canada or Mexico? I know.
Well, the US definition of a successful World Cup, it's hard to say because it's not as big a deal for them as it is for us, you know. It's their sort of, they've got four sports that they watch more than they would watch soccer, even with their big Hispanic communities and everything. But making lots of money is FIFA's primary concern, so it seems. And they're going to do that. They're set to make $13 billion out of this World Cup, which is pretty incredible considering that the Qatar World Cup in 2022, they made, I think, around $7 billion. So that's pretty good inflationary rate.
Where's that coming from?
Well, part of it is because they've got so many teams this time. They've got 48 teams instead of 32. So there's all those extra matches to sell broadcasting rights, sponsorship and tickets. And the ticket pricing has become a really controversial issue.
They're doing dynamic pricing, aren't they? Like the big scandal with Oasis, where
exactly.
People suddenly found that tickets were way, way more expensive than they were when they first got on the phone call to buy one.
Dynamic pricing is amazing for a business because you know you've absolutely maxed out your profit, but it's terrible for spectators because you just have no idea, you know, what there's nothing transparent about the price that you're going to pay. You know, you just have to.
And there have actually been a lot of empty seats visible at the early matches, haven't there?
Yes, exactly. I mean, Infantino said that all tickets were sold in one of his typically grand statements. Yeah. But then where are all these empty seats coming from? And they say, you know,
presumably
that they're all standing in the concourse, but I don't think
presumably it doesn't matter if the people who are in those few seats are paying kind of $3,000 a shot for them, I guess.
That's, exactly.
You make the same amount of money.
Yeah, and across so many matches, you know, there's 103 matches compared to 64. So all you non-football fans have got a lot to look forward to.
And across three countries as well. I mean, we shouldn't forget, even before the Iran stuff, this was being co-hosted by America and one nation that he's constantly accused of putting their rapists and their criminals and their worst people over the border, and one which he's threatened to invade on several occasions, has he? Quite mad to start with.
Well, that's the irony of the Iranian team being based in Mexico, where they are safe, apparently, rather than the USA, where they're not.
I wonder how much of this is about sports betting, though. So there's been a massive success in the last few years since the Netflix documentary Drive to Survive, bringing Formula One.
Do you have to pronounce it like that? Yeah.
Drive to survive.
I can't. I've been watching Clarkson Farm over the weekend. Sorry, it's ruined me. But at the same time, the rise of sports betting, just huge, legalised a couple of years ago in the US, and just people are raking in money from it.
Yes.
And I think that therefore the desire to expand the number of sports and therefore the amount of sports betting that goes on must be enormous. Because they had the Club World Cup, didn't they, in America? That was just a completely random occasion.
Yes, with Trump handing over the trophy, as he's intending to do for this one. I mean, he hasn't been seen at a World Cup match yet, but he is supposed to be there
Well, he's going to be wearing his FIFA Peace Prize medal.
Exactly.
He's got extra, like, he could get put, you know how they put a star on the shirts when from depending on how many World Cups you've won? He can presumably add bars to his FIFA Peace Prize medal.
For every war stop?
That he's ended and or stopped.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's a piece in the latest tie, in the money column, in the back, which is all about the amount of money flooding into the World Cup from the Middle East. And so this is another thing, apart from expanding the number of matches and the number of tickets and all of this.
Yes.
The money coming in, the Saudi Public Investment Fund, Saudi Aramco, Qatar Airways.
Yes.
There are lots and lots of new sources, new revenue streams for FIFA.
Yes. Predict Street, which is a Abu Dhabi-based predictive trading platform.
Yeah.
They're also a sponsor. So, yeah, the Gulf money has kept pouring in. I mean, they always talk about the legacy of sports tournaments, but I don't think they really mean that the 2022 Qatar tournament had a legacy of still raking in a lot of money from the Gulf. So Infantino can top up the coffers with that. So he's got the broadcasting money, the ticket money, and the sponsorship. And there's also an extra little tweak that he's managed this time, which are the hydration breaks.
Love the hydration break. Love the one they were having in the when the matches that was being held in Canada, where it was genuinely like colder than it was here. And you're like, they've just turned it into quarters like an American.
Exactly.
So hydration breaks. Can you fill me in?
So halfway through each half now, they stop play. They have a 3-minute break for hydration. They used to be allowed hydration breaks at the discretion of the referee. So if people were sort of, you know, turning puce and fainting because it was 40 degrees, then maybe they'd let them have some water. But now it's absolutely standard. And they said it was easier to make it standard. I mean, not BBC, obviously. ITV, I noticed, stuck a quick competition for some World Cup tickets in their hydration break. But on Fox Sports, it's been really annoying viewers because, I mean, the first match, Mexico-South Africa, they actually overran the hydration break with the ads. So they came back and they were
too hydrated. When they were,
yes, glug, glug, glug.
And they scored five goals while they were away.
They came back and they were, you know, already playing. So that was very, very annoying to the viewers.
It is, I mean, I've been living in a household with someone who has expressed a desire to watch every single game, which I think he may bail out on because he's got to hold down a job at least for the next couple of weeks. But it does stop, it stops the run of play. This is the kind of phrase that gets said in my household now, and we nod sagely about the run of play. However, they have come up with a different rule, which is about the fact that you can't piss about with throw-ins for a really long time now. So they've found another way to speed up the game.
Right.
But essentially, they have made the game worse in order to serve the needs of advertisers, which is pretty much peak.
And it does change the way the game is played. So your momentum's stopped. So, you know, Morocco are beating Brazil. They have a hydration break. They get some really good advice from their coach and they go back out and score. It's, you know, it's not the way things are supposed to be.
Right.
You don't have the full tension of the half.
Is all of this now locked in for future World Cups?
I think so. I feel like once the genie's out of the bottle, hydration breaks will become a thing.
I mean, in Saudi Arabia,
yes, they'll have to be.
It might be necessary.
It's hot on a hot place.
But Helen's
right. Air-conditioned stadiums, they're going to need that.
Yeah, Germany Curaçao the other night had, you know, a roof and air conditioning, but it still needed a hydration break.
Right.
And they're having a halftime show in the final, so it'll be like a Super Bowl.
Oh, that's good. I like that bit.
Shakira's coming on.
That was fantastic. Yeah,
Shakira and Madonna.
I think we've got through almost a whole section without referring to any actual football, which was always my secret aim at the start of this, is to talk only about the things surrounding football. Does all of this sully the really good name of FIFA as a completely impartial and benevolent sporting body? Or was this always going to be the trashiest, least fan-friendly World Cup ever?
I mean, you always hope that once the action gets underway and the knockouts start, the excitement builds and people get into it and forget about all the politics. But I don't know that the time difference is really anti them in this occasion. And I think there's so much sort of bad taste left by the ticket prices and all these visa exclusions. It's going to be a hard one to get over this time, I think.
Who's getting it next?
So 2030 is a real mishmash. It's Portugal, Spain, Morocco and some centenary matches in South America.
Okay.
Which had the advantage of basically meaning that Europe, Africa and South America were out of contention for the 2034 World Cup on the basis of the rotation system.
You're not suggesting some kind of grubby fix-up.
then luckily Saudi Arabia stepped forward for the 2034 World Cup.
We should just congratulate the Saudi Public Investment Fund once again.
Yes, for their hearty investment.
So there's a by-election coming up in Makerfield, and it seems like the Daily Mail might have started something that it can't quite control. Adam?
Yeah. No, I mean, the situation is that the latest polls in Makerfield show that it's basically a two-horse race. It's Andy Burnham's Labour, as opposed to New Labour, that's what they're now called, Andy Burnham's Labour, versus Nigel Farage's Reform. But Restore are coming right in there and polling at sort of 5 to 8% in the polls, which... he's not going to be enough to get their candidate in as MP, but it is potentially going to split that vote on the right, take votes away from Nigel Farage and let Andy Burnham win by an even larger margin. We don't know what's going to happen for definite yet, but that's sort of what the polls are showing at time of recording.
Yeah.
Now, this is worrying a lot of people who, specifically, I'm going to come down to the Daily Mail, who, after years of telling readers the country's being swamped by immigrants and wokeness, and what's really needed is a return to kind of firm, hardline conservative values, suddenly surprised to find out actually that people might have been listening and they might actually want to vote for that kind of thing as represented by Rupert Lowe. So there's been the most extraordinary coverage over the last few days at time of recording. They've basically noticed something that Private Eye has been pointing out about Rupert Lowe and his outfit and his acolytes for a while, which is that quite a lot of them are quite unpleasant racist people. So the Mail on Sunday splash last weekend was Restore Activists at White Supremacy Summit, reporting that what they described as a hardened neo-Nazi was campaigning for Restore in Makerfield. Also a neo-fascist and ethnic cleansing extremist, someone who not only wants mass deportations, which is Rupert Lowe's policy anyway, but that to include all Jewish people as well, or an awful lot of Jewish
old-fashioned
people.
Nice to see a return to traditional.
Old school neo-Nazis, these people. Old school Nazis, you might even. We could probably take the neo off, couldn't we? Restore's spokesman told the Mail on Sunday that this was totally irrelevant and a hit piece. It was undoubtedly a hit piece, but I would question the total irrelevance of it. So a lot of this seems quite relevant to me. I might well to male readers as well. But it didn't stop there. There was an editorial right in the middle of the story, which was quite an unusual thing in the Mail, and where they actually kind of box out an editorial and whack it right in the middle of the story. Yeah. It said, "How can any reasonable person vote for Restore in Thursday's by-election? And especially, how can anyone support Restore when doing so can help propel the Labour left's great red hope, Andy Burnham, into Downing Street?" So it's kind of, we've told you they're all neo-Nazis and fascists, but actually the real worry here is getting Andy Burnham in. Again, this is the relevancy kind of issue here, I would suggest.
So is it that the papers have been flirting very heavily with Farage and with Reform UK, and now they think their readers have gone too far or taken this to heart?
Essentially, I think that's it. We talked about this before, the slight irrelevancy anyway of newspaper endorsements for political parties, but in this day and age. But both the Mail and the Telegraph, even more so, have been moving very, very far further to the right than the Tory party and kind of lionising Nigel Farage for quite a while now, helped by the fact that he churns out reams of copy for them and lots of op-eds for both of those papers and kind of anyone else that will have him. The Mail is now in a really, really odd position where they've convinced themselves that what has to be done is to unite the right, as they're calling. They actually had that as one of their little stamps that they put on stories. Unite the right.
What, like,
now seems to have turned into unite the right, but not those ones.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Yeah. And they think the answer to all this is that Kemi Badenoch and Nigel Farage should form a great marriage of convenience and everything we want. Actually, bizarrely described by Sarah Vine, Mail and Mail on Sunday columnist last weekend, as turning them into the John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John of British politics, if you can imagine such an image. There you go. But yes, I mean, this is something... I mean, Helen, how honestly likely do you think a pact between the two of them is?
I'm still so stuck on Olivia Newton-John and John. Which one of them's got the hairpiece? Kemi Badenoch spoke to Tim Shipman of The Spectator, and he said, well, she's wavering on it, she's not ruling out. She subsequently came out and said, no, I really do. I really absolutely do. So they have the exact same problem as, if you remember, the kind of Labour SNP stuff in 2015, that they're voters don't want to hear that vote someone and you get someone else.
Yeah.
What I see that Mail thing is a classic pre-by-election squeeze message. So from the point of view of the Mail, whether you're supporting Reform or the Tories, what you most want to happen is you want to max out the UKIP vote, as it was, Reform a vote now, and get the Reform MP, defeat Andy Burnham, humiliation for him, he's knocked out. Labour then have to either continue with an unpopular Prime Minister in Starmer or have some kind of leadership contest with other people who are also stagger on, limp on, And then the great victory in 2028 is won by the right. That's their kind of game plan. What they absolutely don't want is Restore to come and nibble a huge chunk out the side of Reform,
yeah.
Get Andy Burnham. And then the terrible fear, not that he's too left-wing, but that he's good.
Right.
You know, and people like it. You know, that, and therefore they re-elect a Labour government again at the next election. So, you know, I think it's going to be, this is a preview of lots of stuff that's going to happen in the next general election, which is that you're just going to have lots and lots of squeeze messages, and it, right. And every race will be tried to, people will try and get it down to like such and such can't win here. That's going to be quite complicated in a lot of seats. It's not in this one, and it wasn't in Gorton and Denton, as it turned out.
Right. What seems quite clear is that the papers are becoming much less relevant in this. I mean, the whole Restore phenomenon is down to Rupert Lowe's extremely high popularity on all kinds of social media. To a certain extent, Twitter, where he's, you know, he's backed by Musk very heavily.
And he gets an enormous income from Twitter as well.
He gets big income from it. He's monetized
that in a big way, tens of thousands of pounds every year.
But we've been told for a couple of years that Nigel Farage and more recently Zach Polansky are extremely good on social media. Actually, Rupert Lowe has been surprisingly bigger in places like Facebook. And it's where he's been pitching himself much softer than a lot of the rhetoric and a lot of his far-right supporters would have you believe. He's presented as a kind of country squire. He has a farm. There are lots of images of him, you know, with his animals on the farm.
I think that's very telling when you read the Daily Mail copy about Tommy Robinson. So the backstory to this is that Tommy Robinson went to Moscow via Turkey, where he hung out with Errol Musk, who is Elon Musk's...
The even more racist Musk.
Right, very rum father. Yep. And from there was kind of, as ever, interfering in British politics. When he came back, he was detained at the airport and questioned for, on the basis that, you know, we are sort of essentially at war with Russia through Ukraine. And the editorial, the Daily Mail, that wrote against, like, who would let this man into their party. Like Nigel Farage has always had a red line. You know, if you're ever a member of the BNP, you're not in my party. I will not let Tommy Robinson in my party, which is what precipitated his falling out with Elon Musk. But Rupert Lowe did this magnificent thing where he's like, anyone's welcome to join. Like, I'm not in charge of who joins my party. Like, what? Of course you are. Like, that's not how parties work. But anyway, the essential line of that Daily Mail article was, he's a petty mortgage fraudster and a yobbo. And what was the word they used, Adam?
The phrase they used was a bigoted and deeply sinister hoodlum.
A hoodlum?
Yes. I mean, it's thuggery. It's definitely a kind of class-orientated thing that he's the unacceptable face of yobbery and extreme right-wingness, which Rupert Lowe, you know, which he's basically landed gentry. He's got a 550-acre estate in Gloucestershire with an awful lot of barns he's trying to convert into very, very expensive houses.
Huge shepherd's huts.
Yeah, bigger than shepherd's huts.
700,000 pounds.
Yeah. So he's much more to the Daily Mail. I think he'd always been seen as a sort of more accept. I mean, he was a Reform MP. They certainly never objected to him at that point. But I did think that was really, really interesting. The other thing that I thought was really, really interesting, because this continued into Monday's Daily Mail. We had another front page splash which just said "Restore is the new home for neo Nazis." Pretty unequivocal there, which was based on this. You know, Rupert Lowe saying Tommy Robinson was welcome to join the party if he wanted. They ran another, well, it was a very, very odd piece because it read like an op-ed. It read like an editorial line that a columnist would take. It was basically a kind of portrait of Tommy Robinson and his past career and all his criminal convictions and things. But it ended with the words, "Anyone on British soil with eyes in their head and more than a couple of brain cells to rub together can see him for the toxic, hate-fueled rabble-rouser that he is." No sort of messing around there. But it was unsigned. It was bizarre. It seemed like an opinion piece. And it literally, the byline at the top of the page read, "Daily Mail Reporter," which is very odd.
Right.
I can only think of... There's two possible reasons for this. One is that Tommy Robinson and his supporters tend to go after people who displease him in the media because he's a charming man like that. So it's possible they're just trying to protect their job. I mean, we've talked before about how there is a non-existent journalist on the Mail Online called Melody Fletcher, who essentially does all of their reports on people like Taylor Swift and Millie Bobby Brown. And
looking
people
old.
Who have these very, very... that's what they said about it. We should say that's not what we're saying.
No, I'm saying the Daily Mail.
But basically, people who have a kind of rabid online fan base who they know will target individual journalists on social media and come after. So they did put this fake byline on it. But so if it's possible it was that. But I wonder what sort of backlash they got on the Sunday from their readers and whether they're actually worried about enough of their readers who presumably are amongst those 5 to 8% of people in Makerfield and elsewhere who are kind of thinking maybe Rupert Lowe is the way forward.
There is another interesting element, which is that Restore seem to be doing quite well among women, and they are promoting themselves very heavily with a, we want to protect British women and girls. The subtext is pretty clear, you know, from foreign invaders, basically, from being assaulted by foreigners. And Reform have been pushing that very hard at their own conferences, but I think Reform's candidate, you know, with his long record of sexist comments, has put women off quite a bit. Restore are saying, well, look, we've got a, you know, our candidate's a woman, she's called Rebecca Shepherd, and we'll do the thing to protect British women. So I think that might be another.
We should say as well, Rupert Lowe has made that absolutely his specialism. And ironically, I'm now talking over a woman, so I'm going to stop. And
I was going to say the irony is that Carol Vorderman then wrote a letter to all the constituents telling them that, you know, Robert Kenyon was actually really misogynistic and pointing out some of his past comments and saying, do you want a sexist to represent you? So she's boosted Restore's vote among women who've gone, no, you're right, Carol, I'm going to vote for that Restore woman. She's a nice 53-year-old businesswoman that lives locally. And,
I mean, Rupert Lowe has very much made that his kind of cause célèbre, I guess, in a way, is the grooming gangs. He's run his own supposed independent inquiry into all of that, which I think is due to report imminently. So, yeah, he's made that very much his issue.
At the same time that Nigel Farage and others have been very nice about Andrew Tate, who, as far as I can see, a mixed-race Muslim accused of running a grooming gang. Some are saying that maybe they have some double standards in operation.
Yeah.
Should say that Andrew Tate has denied all charges.
Thank you.
We should note as well that all of this has very visibly and obviously pushed Nigel Farage further to the right. I mean, a lot of the comments recently, the pure cold anger after the trial of the killer of Henry Novak and the essay that he wrote over the weekend.
Yeah, he's got a Substack now in which he wrote a piece, and it used very MAGA-type language about DEI, and his big campaign is now against the Equality Act, basically saying that there is anti-white bias.
Right.
And you hear it a lot, you know, and it was, the Novak case was really interesting because he was of Polish extraction, right? It couldn't be framed in the way that Nigel Farage would normally frame it, which is about kind of like, this is about British identity that's under threat from minority groups. It then transmuted from that into white and white European, and white European values are under threat.
I think this is also a response to the fact that immigration has dropped like a stone. So I think the latest net figures is down by about half, and that's not because of British nationals leaving, that's because of many fewer non-EU nationals arriving. It's due to many fewer people who are studying, bringing their families with them, this kind of thing. So immigration's salience has dropped, and I think the focus is now moving in an even more unpleasant way to people of different skin colour who are already here, which is what's driven a lot of Restore's saying we're going to just kick out millions of people, many of whom will legally be here.
Right, and yeah, I guess you're right. In the sense of the inflow, and actually, this, we seem to have had some success with the French in stopping or not stopping the small boats.
Small boat crossings are down 40% year on year. 40% in a year, that's pretty good.
But the issue that you do have is obviously that we're now coming off the several years of record immigration.
Yeah.
So there will be people still in the country. And the other big focus that seems to be now is about social housing. I really understand it because it is incredibly unfair that some people essentially get a golden ticket and get to live in central London for £650 a month or whatever it might be. That is it's something that successive governments have failed to address, the fact that housing is too much for young people. But what's clearly happening is that Reform and Restore and their kind of online outriders are turning that into a classic, and because it's all gone to foreigners, essentially. That year, when in London, where you do have a lot of foreign-born heads of household, I think that is a message that can resonate with young people, because you're talking about Restore and Facebook. That is essentially targeting people 65 and over.
Yeah.
There's an attempt to find a message that will resonate with Nick 30-ons, if you know the online jargon about this, but essentially young people who feel locked out of opportunities. When we, at the moment, we have a younger generation who are much more likely to be voting green, right? If they're looking at Labour and thinking there's something wrong with them, they're going to the left rather than to the right of them.
So we're not going to predict the outcome of the by-election, but I believe there is going to be maybe a special episode soon afterwards, maybe a bonus episode of this very podcast. Is that right?
Not promising anything.
Okay.
But, you know, could happen. Could be an emergency.
An emergency podcast?
There is no such thing.
It's an emergency.
No emergency has ever occurred to which a podcast is the solution.
No, quite right. But there is an emergency issue of Private Eye on newsstands right now, as there always is. So if you'd like it, you could just go into your local newsagent or supermarket and get a copy of the magazine. You can also get a subscription to the magazine at private-eye.co.uk. Subscriptions are unbelievably reasonably priced. A single issue of the magazine will set you back far less than a month of cage fighting on the White House lawn, or whatever it is you were saying, Helen. So that's it for today. Thank you very much to all of you for listening. Thank you to Helen, Adam and Sarah for participating. And thank you to Matt Hill of Rethink Audio for producing. Bye for now.